Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace, joined by John Paul again for an X Tuesday. We're continuing our look at the House of X, Powers of X series from Marvel for this X Tuesday. So last time we talked about House of X number one. This time we're going to take a look at Powers of X number one. And I don't know. Granted, I'm not the biggest X-Men fan in the world, and I don't know everything, unless you're talking about, you know, the classic era of X-Men when it was just one title, you know, Byrne and Claremont and such. I hate to use the word lost. Maybe confused would be a better word when I first read it. I don't know. I mean, we're going to go through it and try to unpack what we can. How did you feel when you first read it, John Paul? Were you kind of felt like you're thrown in the deep end also?
Yeah, it's a lot to unpack, and still now being all caught up and rereading it, there's still some things that are like head scratchers, you know.
And again, to remind everybody, I'm reading these House of X, Powers of X books for the first time. John Paul is pretty much caught up to date with where the X-Men titles are currently with the whole Ten of Swords kind of thing. So you're going to get two perspectives here, and he's not going to give away, you know, anything to me, because, you know, we want me to discover these things, you know, with first impressions, where he's going to go back and check them out again with, you know, kind of the forethought of what comes next. But if I'm hearing what you're saying, right, you went back and read Powers of X number one. There's still stuff in here that Hickman hasn't gotten to explaining yet.
Even more so than in House of X.
Okay. Well, yeah. That doesn't necessarily surprise me. I mean, he does play the long game, and there is a lot of stuff in here.
Yeah, that's for sure.
But the other part is, does he sometimes bite off more than he can chew? How long is he going to, like, how long is Marvel going to keep going with this, you know, Krakoa and Mutant Nation and that kind of thing?
As long as it sells.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, but I mean, even if it's 10 years, I don't know that Hickman gets to everything, because he's just such a big idea guy, which, you know, I guess it's okay. I mean, we have seen some sort of house ads and marketing stuff from Marvel recently about Heroes Reborn. And there was some talk from Tom Brevoort on a panel toward the end of last year, talking about a rebirth for the Marvel Universe, and probably not a rebirth in the same way that DC did rebirth. We were kind of wondering what those comments meant when Brevoort made them. And now that we've seen these Heroes Reborn images, and it is this year, 2021, is the 25th anniversary of Heroes Reborn. So, you know, it may not be the big, well, it's certainly not going to be a big reboot or relaunch or whatever of the Marvel Universe, but it could be, we could see some new number ones come out of it. It wouldn't surprise me. So
I haven't heard about this, to be honest.
Yeah, they just barely started putting out some Heroes Reborn images this week. And we saw some things like a Juggernaut, I think it was Magneto, like hybrid character. But here's the thing about Heroes Reborn. When it happened in 1996, you had, you know, the Iron Man title ended, the Hulk title ended, Avengers ended, Captain America ended, and Fantastic Four ended. And then they launched four titles. They didn't relaunch Hulk, but they launched an Avengers, a Fantastic Four, a Captain America, and an Iron Man. And Hulk was kind of part of the Iron Man one. So it kind of left the whole X corner of the Marvel Universe alone. Even though, when you think about it, the X-Men did have a lot to do with Heroes Reborn, that universe happening, because the in-story reason was that Onslaught, who actually was Professor Xavier, he killed those heroes, and that's why their titles ended. And then there was a new version of them in this alternate universe, and then eventually they all came back. But really, it was a marketing ploy. Sales were in the tank. It was the middle of the 90s, where we were just getting into the big crash. And Heroes Reborn was, so not only did they relaunch these titles, they brought on Image creators to do them. So you had like Rob Liefeld doing Avengers and Captain America, and you had Jim Lee and his Wildstorm Studios doing Iron Man and Fantastic Four. And then, you know, that lasted about a year, and then they brought everybody back. So how will they celebrate it this year? Will it not touch the Powers of X, Dawn of X, House of X corner? Probably not. It probably won't. So Hickman will still continue. But I wouldn't be surprised if we got some new number ones for Iron Man and Captain America, Avengers, Fantastic Four. Wouldn't necessarily surprise me. But anyway, let's go ahead and talk about the Powers of X. Number one, it starts with a interesting cover. There's some characters, like when I looked at it, in the background, you've got what looks, it's a brunette girl. Having read the issue, and now I know it's Moira. At the time when I looked at the cover, I wasn't sure. Is that Jean Grey? Is it Kitty Pryde? Not really sure. Juxtaposed against her, facing the other direction, bald guy, clearly Xavier. That's not a tough one to figure out. Then you had some sort of robotic looking figure, kind of looked like Nimrod, but I wasn't sure because it wasn't necessarily an iteration of him that I'd seen before. And then you had what looked like a female Cyclops and a red colored Nightcrawler. So I wasn't sure. I mean, three fingers like Nightcrawler, wasn't sure. And then some other characters that I had no idea, no clue who these were. So turning to the first page, we get one of those Hickman design pages. Here's the thing, Charles, it's not a dream if it's real. And that's a quote from Moira McTaggart. So as we turn to the first page, we see X to the zero power, the X-Men year one, the dream. And these are basically all pictures of different characters, the first one being Charles Xavier, apparently somebody from that era. So when you talk about X to the zero power, that is, you know, year one, when Professor X, I guess, first comes up with the idea of the X-Men, because it says, you know, X to the zero power, the X-Men, year one, the dream. He's got the dream. This is what can happen. Next panel below that, we see him, the Professor X that we know from House of X number one, with the big giant fishbowl on his head, can't see his eyes, a little bit malevolent like we talked about last time. Now we're at X to the one power, the X-Men year 10, the world. So does this mean it's when they've taken over the world, they've created their own world? Not sure, but that seems to be sort of present time as opposed to the first panel, which is Charles Xavier in the past. Then when we get to X squared, or X to the second power, the X-Men, now we're talking about year 100, the war. So what that war is, well, the character there looks to be that futuristic robotic Nimrod kind of looking character. Again, I'm not sure at this point if it is Nimrod. When you talk about a war, well, if it's a war and you're talking Nimrod, that's, you know, humans versus Sentinels. So is it the war for mutant kind to have their ability to survive? And whoever it is, you know, the government, Trask, whoever, William Stryker, I mean, who knows? Somebody has declared war on mutants. They're looking to take him out. Then the last panel, some blue-skinned person with a lighter-colored blue tattoo on their cheek and these like black or red type eyes with like no iris or pupil, just all one color. They look black, but they have red highlights, so I'm not sure. And now we're X to the third power, X cubed. The X-Men, now we're talking about 1,000 years, year 1,000. So clearly a lot of time has gone by and we're talking about the Ascension. So, you know, I look at this and I'm immediately like, wait, what? So Hickman is trying to give us 1,000 years of X-Men history. Is that what we're doing here? Again, sort of confusing. So we turn to the next page, X to the zero power, the X-Men year one, we're at some sort of carnival. We see Charles Xavier kind of strolling around. He sits on a bench. He's smiling. Seems like he's in a good mood. He's watching the birds, looking around. And Moira McTaggart walks up and says, "Good afternoon." He says, "Same to you. Are you enjoying the fair?" And she says, "Yes. Seems like the kind of thing I should enjoy." I look around all these people, and it just looks like it's a show for people who need a show, I guess. And it's a distraction from what's really going on. Do you mind if I sit? And so what she means by that distraction of what's really going on, like what is she talking about? And we'll find out later. It's kind of foreboding what she says here. But anyway, she sits down next to Charles and she asks him if he's enjoying the fair. He said, oh, you know, it seems like it should be something I should enjoy. You know, parting of the clouds, sunshine, everything seems right with the world. And Moira's like, well, you are having a good day. He says, well, is it that obvious? She says, well, you'd have to be blind not to notice. What I notice on this page is there's one panel where Professor Xavier doesn't have any eyes, just these two black dots for pupils. I don't know if that's just bad art from R.B. Silva or if there's some significance to it.
It's kind of funny, isn't it?
But yeah, it looks just really weird. I don't know if something has happened in the art process, but it just pulled me out of the story big time. I was like, wait, what the heck's going on? So anyway, as we turn the page, Moira getting a little deep here. She starts talking, says, in my case, I was walking by the fair, by the caged beast, games of chance, past the fortune tellers selling his wares. And then I guess we get some prelude with these tarot cards that are sort of a prelude for the, what I'm going to say is the confusing rest of the issue. And she says, see the magician, the metal metamorph. So somebody who transforms into metal, the great sword and the girl with one foot in two worlds. And that's the magician card. And it's the picture on the card looks like the girl on the front cover that looked like Cyclops that had the sword, or not Cyclops rather, but Colossus. And that would make sense. You know, you talk about somebody who can transform into metal, a metal morph, but who she is, you know, no idea. Second card says, see the tower, the access, the pillar and collapse and rebirth, the monolith of ascension. And that card is called the tower. No clue about any significance of that. And then the last one is the devil. And that on that card looks like that red skin version of Nightcrawler. And it says, see the devil, the red god, and the lost cardinal of the last religion. So Moira goes on to tell Charles, at the far end of the fair, I saw you sitting here. And I thought to myself, there he is, what I've been looking for, the strong man. And the way she says it, it's like, what is he, another tarot card, the strong man? And he tries to say, I'm not really that strong. She says, I wondered why he would be sitting here in the sun. Why was the strong man smiling so? And Professor X says, well, yeah, I guess I was smiling. Do you want to know why? And she says, yeah, very, very much so. He says, I was smiling because I recently had the most wonderful dream of a better world and my place in it. And Moira says, and here's that quote from the very first page. Well, here's the thing, Charles. It's not a dream if it's real. So thinking back to what we know so far in the issue, that first page, year zero of the X-Men, the dream, right? So when Charles first comes up with that idea. So to me, this means that, okay, he just recently has come up with the idea of, yeah, let's create the X-Men. Let's unite mutants and sort of create this organization that can do what it can to help the world in times of trouble and also be a force to protect other mutants, a school to train mutants and to try to protect our own. And with Moira saying that, well, here's the thing, it's not a dream if it's real, very much seems like she knows something about the future and she knows something that, you know, that he doesn't. So it makes you wonder about what she said earlier when she first sat down on the bench and she talked about the fair being a distraction for those that need a distraction from what's really going on. So she seems to know something about mutants or the future or something like that, but we're not really sure what. So when she says that, you know, it's not a dream if it's real, he's like, wait, do I know you? And she says, oh, we go back quite a ways. And so he says, well, who are you? She says, well, why don't you read my mind and see? And he doesn't even question, like, wait, how does this girl that I apparently just met know that I can read minds? So I guess he figures, well, the easiest way for me to find out is just to read her mind. So, you know, we see him with the James McAvoy pose with the two fingers on the temple. And, you know, it's a great art by R.B. Silva, the look on Xavier's face where, you know, he just got this information download and he says, ah. So I turn the page next. We get the credits page. So written by Jonathan Hickman, R.B. Silva. as the artist, or I guess it would be the penciler, because RB Silva and Adriano Di Benedetto are listed as inkers, Artea Garcia on colors, and Clayton Cowell doing the letters, Tom Muller on design. Turn the page next. Now we're jumping. Now we're year 10, which when you think about it, it's interesting to think. It's that whole comic book timeline. You know, Marvel had the same kind of problems with the New 52. Because here we are, year 10, and clearly Krakoa exists. Because, you know, we see the X-Men year 10, Krakoa. We see Toad and Mystique show up and, you know, playing off of their storyline that we saw in the first issue of House of X, where they had gone to the Damage Control Incorporated data center, or whatever you want to call it, and grabbed all that information along with Sabretooth. So you're telling me that 10 years ago, Xavier was just putting the X-Men together, like just had the idea to put the X-Men together. And now in only 10 years, we're already at the point of Krakoa. Because you talk about publishing time. And again, I know you can't go 100% by publishing time, but let's even forget about the first era of the X-Men, you know, the original five. Let's even just take the year that the new X-Men showed up, right? So, you know, Nightcrawler and Storm and Colossus and Banshee, Sunfire, you know, that team. You're talking about like what, 1979, 78, somewhere in there. So that's, what is that, 40 years ago, 40 plus years ago? And everything that's happened, like think about all those events from the Mutant Massacre to Age of Apocalypse to Avengers versus X-Men. Like, it's a lot. It's a lot of history, a lot of X-Men history, and you're condensing that down. Like, I don't know. That just doesn't, like, when I saw that, I'm like, huh, I get maybe why you want to condense it down that much, but I just don't know that it works. But I guess comics, and you just kind of, you know, let it roll off you and just take it for what it is. Anyway, they do arrive. Apparently it's only been 10 years since Xavier first thought up the X-Men. And Mystique has the device, the flash drive, that has all the information that she was able to get from Damage Control. She goes to House of M, which is a certain area in Krakoa. Again, there's a map in that first House of X issue. And Magneto's there. Hey, good that you're back. Have you noticed the place or noticed the effect this place is having? You know, the fact that we have our own nation now. All of a sudden, overnight, Krakoa feels like it's full of hope and dreamers and true believers. He says, even I, one shaped so much by the cruelty of this world, feel as if I'm being infected by this positivity around here. So, I'm dreaming of success. Do you? And she says, well, we lost Sabretooth, and he didn't do us any favors. He killed guards, even though we were trying to keep it, you know, on the down low. But yeah, Magneto, I have it. So she sort of takes him, and maybe that's what he means, and he's just kind of poking fun, but she doesn't take it as kind of the abstract success. She takes it as him asking, did you succeed in your mission? That's the way she answers the question anyway. And so he says, oh, well done. And he goes to grab it from her, and she pulls it away from him and says, hold on, I have some demands. And then we see Fishbowl Xavier show up, and he's like, oh, do you now? Helping your fellow mutants is not enough. She says, no, it isn't. I need more. He said, okay. Clearly he reads her mind, because we get the McAvoy again, this time only on the fishbowl. Can't actually touch his own temple. He goes, oh, okay, I see what you want. Yeah, that's fair. We have further demands as well. And then he uses his powers of telekinesis to pull the flash drive out of her hand and brings it to him, using the force, as it were. And she's like, oh, really? He said, yeah, I'm afraid so. And she turns around on him. Oh, helping your fellow mutants isn't reward enough. And his response to that, Fishbowl Xavier's response to that, is, well, we're building a better mutant world, Mystique. So everybody who wants to live in that world owes something. You know, you got to do your part, basically, is what he's saying. Then we jump again, another time jump. This one even more. Now, instead of jumping 10 years, we're jumping 90 years. We're at the X squared, the X-Men year 100. And we see somebody who has been killed, basically a mutant, one of the ones on the front cover. And he has some sort of device attached to his head that apparently is like sucking out his knowledge, I'm thinking is what it does. And as he expires, as he passes away, he says, "There was a dream. Our dreams are the same. While the world slept, the world changes." And we're told that we're in Northern Territory in the Nexus. And there's some person, some woman there who's in some gray and black armor with like some purple highlights. She says, "This one's dying." And there's some sort of robotic sentry or robot or weapon or something that has these three weird heads and is very spindly looking. And in response to her saying this one's dying, he says, "Well, were you able to salvage anything from its mind? Should I set my expectations more toward the human end of the spectrum?" So basically what he's saying is, it's dying. Did you get anything useful from it? Or as a human, did you fail again? Right? Like very Terminator-esque or, you know, artificial intelligence. And the woman responds, "Well, bad news on that front." And of course the robot, not surprised. Oh, of course, you know, leave it to the weak human who can't do anything right. And she says, "No, they're wiping their minds when they die now. It's some kind of mnemonic trigger when they start to flatline." So apparently that phrase that this mutant was reciting as he died, "There was a dream, our dreams are the same, while you slept, the world changed." That was the phrase that he needed to say in order to wipe his own memory. So whoever these people are that the mutants are fighting against aren't able to pull information. You know, he may know the location of a base or, you know, their plans or what have you. So the robot says, "And the other mutant," because apparently they were tracking too. And the scene shifts on the next page and we see the other mutant. And another human is saying, "We know her as Cyobel. She was born in the kennel." And the Cyobel, she's kind of strange looking. She's got like a clear plexiglass plate over the top of her head that shows her brain. And we're told that she was bred as a black brain telepath. A natural Judas subversion was written into her DNA, and normal field protocol is sure to fail. They say, "We'll have to give her a bath." And so this evil robotic kind of thing says, "Well, let's not give up so easily. Where's your human ingenuity that you always like to talk about, right? Like maybe the current situation that the Cyobel is finding herself in makes her feel like conversing, you know, maybe she's going to trade information for her life." And then they address her saying, "Does it sound right to you? You want to tell us where your friends are, why they're here in the Nexus, and where the rest of them, you know, ran off to?" And she says, what friends?" And the robot says, "Okay, I see. So you're going to be needing persuasion, huh? So I guess going to torture her." And as this robotic, whatever it is, says that, the camera pans back and we see in the foreground probably those same mutants that they're looking for. There's a couple of them there. So on the next page, we see that there are the two of them. It's the red-skinned Nightcrawler-looking clone and the female Colossus type that transforms into metal. And they're all actually in communication. Cyobel and this red-skinned mutant who apparently is named Rasputin. Or I'm sorry, actually, I think the female is named Rasputin and the red-skinned one is named Cardinal. And then the one with the mental powers that has the plate on the skull is Cyobel. So they're all in communication. And Cyobel is saying, "You know, you got to let me go. Don't try to save me. You know, there's so much blood on my hands before you save me, before you name me. And it was for nothing if you two don't make it back." So apparently Cardinal and Rasputin have some sort of information that the rest of whoever they're working with need. And Cyobel doesn't want them to lose that information by these two trying to rescue her. And we do know that as we read on here, we'll point out when we come across it, but basically Cyobel's a hound, right? So a mutant that was bred or born or subjected to some sort of conditioning that turns them against their own kind, and they then hunt other mutants. And clearly, whatever organization Rasputin and Cardinal belong to managed to free her and, you know, gave her a name. So that's what they meant earlier when they said that, you know, she's bred to be a Judas. So Rasputin is like, well, maybe you're right. Maybe we have to go now. And Cardinal apparently wants to leave, and Rasputin, the female metamorph, is like, you know, Rasputin, just because you were bred as a coward. So apparently this red-skinned mutant isn't a fighter, as it were. She says, if you want to run, then go ahead. I won't. So this female metal-skinned mutant is not willing to just give up on Soluble yet. Meanwhile, she is beginning to be tortured. And Cardinal says, well, I'm going to plant the black seed of Krakoa. So he's going to plant a seed that's going to open a gate for them to get to Krakoa. So whoever they're working with, I'm assuming it's a group of mutants, even though we're 100 years in the future, Krakoa still exists. And Rasputin goes on to, or Cardinal rather goes on to say, I'm going to wait for you as long as I can before I close it on the other side. So, you know, hurry, basically. And Rasputin's like, well, great. So you're not going to help me try to rescue her, but, you know, you're at least going to pray for me. And he says, oh, of course, my faith is boundless. I pray for all living things. It's like, yeah, that's your problem, priest. Like, why would you pray for your enemies? So Rasputin leaps out of her hiding place with the big energy sword, and she starts attacking all the different machines that are there, torturing Sciobel, including the three-headed, spindly-looking one that seems to be in charge. And as she attacks, she tells Cardinal, yeah, the problem is you forget that machines have no souls, because apparently who they're fighting, who's left, apparently is just a bunch of machines, and maybe even the humans that we see torturing Sciobel aren't even fully human. And she says the humans lost theirs a long time ago. So whatever this force is, or this entity or group that they're fighting, it seems to be made up of machines and maybe man-machine hybrids, or just straight humans, but clearly it's the mutants against whoever, right? They're on their own. So she attempts to free Sciobel, manages to take out a couple of the people that were holding her and that big robot. And again, she's communicating to Sciobel telepathically, saying, okay, let's get you home. The priest is growing the gate, and, you know, hopefully we'll be able to get you home. And Cardinal saying, yeah, just hold them off a little bit longer. And Rasputin saying, yeah, I can do that. I was made for it. And the humans that are attacking her say, nothing's phasing her. She metal or plasma. One of the others says, we need backup. I'm calling in a tank. So apparently a tank is a big giant sentinel, because right as the gate opens and Rasputin is about to grab Sciobel and head out there, there's one of the, you know, giant sentinels that tries to crush her with its hand. She manages to chop it off, but then, you know, his other hand starts fighting against her, and the other humans or human machine hybrids manage to trap Sciobel in some sort of like force bubble. And they say, okay, we've got her. We're withdrawing. Let's take this prisoner back. And the rest of you, you know, see if you can capture the other one before she makes it through the gate. So Rasputin's not about to give up, and she does attack the humans that are there trying to rescue Sciobel. And Sciobel's again telling her, hey, you have no choice. You got to leave me behind and escape. And Rasputin, again, doesn't want to give up. She's very heroic. She says, I'll die here before I give up. And Sciobel's begging her, leave, please. And we see Rasputin kind of getting overwhelmed. And then we get a couple of pages of text, big info dump on the next pages here, sort of explaining. And again, we talked about this last time when we covered House of X number one. I get why Hickman is doing it this way. You know, we talked about it last time. It's so much information and such a different take on mutants and the story he's trying to tell here. And certainly when you start talking about X0, you know, year one, and then 10 years on, and then 100 years on, and 1,000 years on, there's a lot to fill in. There's no easy way to do it. So he's decided to use these text pages like he likes to do, And even then you're not fully aware, because it's not like, you know, you're reading a novel. And that's really what it would take to sort of explain these really ambitious ideas that he has. So the first page is called The Sinister Line. And we're told about a mutant breeding program. Apparently, when the population level of mutants reached a crisis point, and there was the constant evasion, relocation, confrontation cycle, they call it, made systemic mutant propagation impossible. So the remaining mutant leadership endorsed and improved the creation of the sinister breeding pits of Mars. And if that sounds as bad as you think it does, you're right. It sure is. So, you know, we're talking about sometime between year 10 and Krakoa, which is basically present day, and this 100 years in the future that we just saw, which is sort of dystopian. Mutants were at war. They were being hunted, right? That's where the evasion part comes in. So they're so busy being on the run and relocating from place to place and being confronted to fight these battles. And it's a constant cycle. And they're not even able to, because of that sort of unstable existence, they're not even able to keep their numbers up. And so we're told, under the hand of the chief mutant geneticist, Mr. Sinister, which again, he's such a bad guy. Why would you ever trust him? But anyway, the strategy mirrored the Earth-based Sentinel Hound program. So that's what I was just talking about, where, you know, you capture mutants or you breed mutants to be brainwashed and to hunt other mutants. And so they set up these breeding pits of Mars, apparently, with Mr. Sinister in charge. And instead of focusing on interbreeding mutants with powers that helped find and pursue other mutants, the Sinister strategy focused on mutants with power sets that had more aggressive and militaristic traits. So the mutants are at war with machines or humans or both, and they don't have enough. They're not keeping their numbers up. You know, they're not reproducing fast enough to win the war. They're going to be basically hunted to extinction, right? They're going to lose the war of attrition. And so they turn to Mr. Sinister and say, hey, let's start breeding mutants. Let's just start creating them in test tubes, basically. And instead of like with the Hound program, where you're focusing on powers that can detect mutants and chase after them and catch them, instead, we're going to focus on mutants that have certain powers that will help in our war against other against these machines and humans. And we're also told that this remaining mutant leadership that made this choice to have Mr. Sinister do this, it followed this decision. These lost years of mutant leadership followed the almost universal death or disappearance of all the senior leaders. And it happened before the fall of Krakoa and Mars. And many believe that those lost years were not accidental, but purposeful. So what they're saying is, like, all the voices of reason that would have objected to doing this, they all seem to have disappeared. And then magically, Mr. Sinister is there to sort of say, oh, well, I have a solution to our problem. Let's breed mutants. So on the next page, we're told about Chimera, which is the first generation of sinister mutants. They were uniformly designed to be divergent copies of a singular DNA source. So a pure, uncompromised X gene, commonly referred to as fodder inside the breeding pits. So these mutant soldiers were trained in the Martian underground until they reached the age of 16. And then they would travel to Krakoa and defend the mutant state until it fell 30 years later. The second and third generation of sinister mutants were referred to as the Chimera class. So first generation fodder, second and third Chimera. The second Chimera generation produced mutants that had DNA composed of two different genes, resulting in a mutant that had the most predictable combined power set of the source mutants. The third Chimera generation produced mutants with an amalgamated DNA made of up to five X genes. So it seems like Sinister was getting better at this as he was going along. Like, first, he just had to use one DNA source, and basically you're just making clones at that point. Second generation, he learned a little more. He was able to combine DNA from two different mutants. So now they've got two powers. Third generation, now he's combining five different X genes. So it's giving them, making them even more powerful. They have more powers to draw on. And it says, outside of a predictable failure rate, the third generation of chimeras was universally successful against the man-machine supremacy. So apparently that's what this coalition of humans and machines is called, the man-machine supremacy. So that's what we just saw, those machines and those humans working together to try to capture these mutants. And it goes on to say, many believe that this would be the turning point in the war, right? You've got this third generation of chimeras where you're creating mutants that have five different powers. And yes, there is a failure rate, but most of the time, you're successful in creating a mutant, and these mutants are very successful in waging a war against this man-machine supremacy. However, the fourth generation of sinister mutants suffered a systemic failure. So the entire batch of these Omega-based chimera mutants was produced with a corrupted hive mind that was only discovered to be defective after they had destroyed 40% of the remaining mutant population and caused the fall of Krakoa itself. So maybe Sinister got a little too cocky when he went, okay, like this third generation, third batch was great. They had, you know, five different powers and were winning the war. And apparently, I mean, we're not told here why. So why did the fourth generation have a hive mind? That's what we don't understand, but because that's apparently what was different. Corrupted with, you know, they were produced with a corrupted hive mind, only discovered to be defective after they come alive and turned on the other mutants to destroy 40% of the remaining mutant population, caused Krakoa to fall. And they eventually then committed mass suicide, collapsing Mars and the Sinister Pits and themselves into a self singularity. So not great. Yeah, not good, basically. So, right. Sounds like the mutants were doing well. They had this generation of chimeras that was successful in fighting the man-machine supremacy, but then, you know, with the next batch, it all sort of fell apart. And then at the bottom of that page, we see a sample of the chimera, the Rasputin. So again, this is sort of what we're talking about in terms of, is this the same powers that Rasputin had that we just saw, the girl with the sword that could transform into metal? And apparently we see the different DNA samples. One says the name is Choir, so I'm assuming it comes from Quentin Choir, can't even say that. And the powers, it says Tela, so I'm assuming teleportation. Next sample's named Rasputin, and it's Metamorph, so being able to transform into metal. Next one is Bane, and I'm assuming that's Bane as in Unas, the Untouchable, because the power is Force Field. Next we have Pride as the name of the sample, so I'm assuming Kitty Pride. Powers Intangibility. Next name is Kinney. I don't know who that is.
Laura Kinney.
I was going to say, unless they're referring to X-23, because the power is Healing. So interesting that they didn't choose to take it from Logan. So, but yeah, so a healing factor, intangibility, force field, metal morph, so you have Colossus power turn into organic steel, and teleportation. You can see why, if you had a mutant that had all those abilities, they'd be pretty damn powerful. Mm-hmm. They would be almost unstoppable, you know? I mean, Unas, the Untouchable, he turns his power on, and you literally can't touch him. And, you know, obviously you need to be able to turn that on and off, because if you go too far, it pushes everything away, including air molecules. You can't breathe. You can't eat, you know, turn it on high enough and gravity won't even affect you. You'll fly off into space. But yeah, I mean, intangibility, healing, metamorph, teleporting seems like, you know, it'd be pretty powerful. On the next page, we're told about outliers. So like any experiment, Sinister's breeding program would produce results that fell outside of the expected range, failure rate, and each generation of chimeras had outliers, but the expectation with these failures would be controllable at worst and acceptable at best. And as the mutants got more complicated, you see the failure rate go up. So the first generation, where you're just using one sample, the failure rate's only 0.3%. So at that point, you're just cloning people, like I said, right? Generation two, where you're mixing two DNA samples, the failure rate's 1.2%. So maybe there's some kind of mutation, or, you know, they don't mix correctly, and you do get a failure of about one in every 100. Generation three, it jumps up by a significant amount. You're talking about a 9.4%. So almost one in 10, you know, almost 10% failure rate. But again, you're mixing five different samples. So you could see why it would go up so much. You know, generation two, you're only mixing two samples. Bump it up to five, you're going to see a big increase, or just more of a chance of something going wrong. Generation three, it says, had a 10% failure rate, where in spite of their being bred for war, these mutants developed passive peacetime power sets. Almost all of these outlier mutants also had personality profiles that lent themselves to pacifism and an obsession with creation myths. They also rejected the idea of personal identities and refused individual names. These variants were all called cardinal. So interesting, right? And we're not even talking about a failure rate with generation three of like they just died, or they came out deformed or misshapen or whatever. You're talking about a failure rate of, instead of these mutants developing some or all of those powers that we just talked about, but instead they developed some sort of passive powers. They're called peacetime power sets here. And not only did they develop sort of useless powers, powers that were of no use in fighting a war, their personalities were such that they weren't fighters. They wanted to be pacifists, and they were obsessed with the idea of creation myth. If what that means, they're obsessed with religion, you know, and they all wanted to be called cardinal. So we just met one of those, the red-skinned guy, right? That looked like Nightcrawler, but with red skin, and how he, you know, the other Rasputin was telling him, hey, you know, why don't you pray for me? So clearly the whole religion thing, the creation myth, and not wanting to fight and being a pacifist. So just because it's a failure doesn't mean that the clone or the mutant or whatever you want to call it died. It's just they weren't of use, you know. Help out as much as you can, but they're not really of use in actually fighting the war. Then we're told about the betrayal. So the fall of Krakoa, the destruction of the breeding pits, it was all preceded by the betrayal of mutants by Mr. Sinister. So again, why did you think this was a good idea? And in retrospect, it's obviously Mr. Sinister was playing a long game of self-interest that superseded any alliance. So right from the beginning, he was always planning on betraying them. And it says, while the failings of the Generation 4 mutants were clearly a design flaw that were baked into design, it's now believed that most of the random circumstances that led to the creation of Sinister's program were in fact orchestrated by him. So he did it on purpose, basically. He, for whatever reason, you know, created these four different generations, maybe just to play God like he likes to do, knowing, okay, once I have enough knowledge after doing the first three generations, I'm going to create the fourth generation, which I know is going to lead to the downfall of mutants. But clearly it didn't work out the way he necessarily thought, because we're told that Sinister was publicly executed by the man-machine supremacy after defecting. So he thought he had a deal with the man-machine supremacy and said, okay, going to make them think they're winning. We're going to create the third generation, very effective at fighting in the war. And then the fourth generation is going to lead to their downfall, and I'll go live happy life with the, you know, with whatever the man-machine supremacy is going to bring me. But actually, when he gets over there, they're like, all right, thanks for helping us win the war, and they kill him. So some would say he got what he deserved. So after all those pages, again, it's a lot of information. I said the first time when we talked about the first issue, I wasn't a big fan of this kind of thing. But I see it, you know, John Paul's telling me, yeah, it's a lot of info, and it's they're good. You know, I like them. I'm not all the way on board yet, John Paul, but I will say that I get your point. Like, I just don't know how you would possibly convey in comic form all this information without it taking like
multiple issues,
like a whole 30 issue series in and of itself. Like, yeah, I just don't see it. And it is kind of cool to see, like, you know, the different graphics with the powers and the samples and everything. And, you know, you get to go, okay, so this power is this, and not, you know, one thing I didn't mention when we were talking about, you know, the Quentin Quire is teleportation, and that's or maybe it's telekinetics. Yeah, it must be, now that I think about it, because Quire, but they have numbers assigned to them. I'm assuming that's like the level of it, right? So telekinetics is 10, metamorph 6. When you talk about healing factor, it's only 4. So yeah, interesting thing to look at. And again, I just don't know how you convey all this information other than the way Hickman is doing it. And it's a little more interesting than just giving us a, I don't know, a big dry Marvel official handbook of the Marvel Universe entry book in the middle of the comic, I guess. Anyway, so we go back to the next page, and we're now at the Tower of Nimrod the Lesser, the human machine monolith. So if you think back to that tower we were told about, the tarot card that Moira McTaggart saw at the beginning of the issue, and Nimrod the Lesser. So I'm assuming this is some sort of descendant of the Nimrod Sentinel that we first became aware of in Days of Future Past, that real classic X-Men story. So Nimrod is there, and yeah, we do see it is that same Nimrod version that we see on the cover and that we saw on the first page. And he says to some underling of his, I guess, "Look, Omega, it appears as if your faith in humanity has paid off once again, because those human soldiers are coming in. They're bearing a gift, which is Cyobel." And they kneel there and they say, "Great Nimrod, we're seek your counsel." He's like, "Okay, well, what's going on? We're equals." And they say, "What do you need, Hunter?" And she explains, "Well, 4 mutants penetrated the Nexus earlier and accessed the mainframe. We don't know how they gained entry. And at least one escaped, one died, and we captured one. So we don't even know what happened to Rasputin. The one that escaped, we know that to be Cardinal. One died, we saw that. Didn't have a name, but we saw them trying to extract information, and he basically killed himself, erased his brain. One is captured, that's Cyobel. And here's where we're told she once was a hound. So that's what we're talking about before, where she was telling Rasputin to leave her. You know, she was rescued and, you know, turned away from being a Judas and being a mutant and hunting other mutants. But we're not told what happened to Rasputin, whether or not she escaped or not. So Omega says, "Yeah, this it's a hound, and isn't this interesting, Nimrod? It's from the Salcin kennel, and you're looking at the last strain of the mutants that were produced by our breeding program." So, talking about these hounds here, and what Cyobel herself is, the man machine supremacy was, as we were told in the text pages there, they were producing their own mutants, just like Sinister was. They were breeding hounds that are able to detect and chase down other mutants. So Nimrod says, "Okay, look at me, mutant. When I say this, I'm sorry for what we did." You know, he's basically apologizing for some reason, the fact that they created the hounds in the first place. He says, "I'm ashamed and embarrassed what we did in the name of expediency and annihilation. You know, we bred you not only to be a slave, but to be a betrayer of your people. And, you know, when we're trying to create a good and just world, how did higher functioning programs like ourselves ever think that would be a good idea?" So it really seems quite full of himself. Like they have won, you know, or feel like they've won the war, or they're so close to winning the war that now they can, you know, kind of give that faux passive aggressive benevolence. "Oh, we did these terrible things in the interest of justice, and we should have known better, and blah, blah, blah." It's like, dude, just no, that's, you're evil, and no way you dress it up is going to make it any better. Right. But now that you're in power, you get to, you know, you won the war, and the people that win the war get to write the history. And it seems like he's already rewriting it. He goes on to say, "Yeah, personally speaking, I actually find it encouraging that your generation, your litter, failed us so miserably. Bad ideas should die a bad death. And I find hope in that. You should too." And she says, "Well, you know what? If it takes 1,000 years, I swear we're going to endure, and we're going to erase you from existence." So Cyobel's not giving up hope. She still thinks that the mutants can win the war against the man machine supremacy. And, you know, again, with the arrogance, Nimrod's like, "Oh, that's the spirit. I love it." Clearly thinking that they're not a, you know, not a threat at all. So Omega, kind of his right hand's like, "Well, that day's not today. And of course he would betray, your, you know, your fellow mutants. People betray it all the time. So, you know, you've done it before. You were a Hound. Let's go ahead and start with, some interrogation. And the woman's like, well, we tried that, but you know, she's bred to withstand, you know, we bred her ourselves. She's bred to withstand interrogation so that if she ever is captured, she's not going to, you know, give up any information. So the other human there says, well, we could give her a bath and see what comes out of the wash. And Nimrod likes that idea. And Omega seems to think about it. She's like, oh, the AI is still pretty young. It's still learning and parsing the data. It may take a while. You know, we could find what we need tomorrow, or it might take decades. So are you sure you want to give it a try? And the female human's like, well, what else can we do? So Nimrod says, all right, well, let's go ahead and try it. So basically what they do is they stick her in this sort of tube of something or other. He calls it a repository. And they basically are going to submerge her in this and sort of melt her, disintegrate her. I don't know what the right phrase would be. But the way he puts it, he says, you're going to be submerged and you're going to be suspended and distilled down to nothing but data. So they're basically transforming her from this biological creature into just data. And one of their AIs is going to basically take all that data and parse it. So it's going to start combing through the data. All, you know, her whole physical being is going to be, I guess, transformed into ones and zeros. I'm assuming they still work in binary here. They haven't advanced that far that they're working in some other more advanced way. So all her physical being is going to be transformed into ones and zeros. And then they're going to have an AI that goes through that and looks for pattern so that it can then try to translate that and break it down into information. So that's why Omega was saying, yeah, well, who knows what data we're going to be able to extract, and then who knows how long it's going to take the AI to maybe gain any useful knowledge out of that information. But they tortured her they used whatever interrogation technique they had and tried to get information from her and weren't able to. So they figure, well, this is, you know, the best we can do. And Nimrod says, yeah, the AI is curated of my own brood. And unfortunately for one of mine to flourish, many of yours must perish, including you, right? So as you fade away to nothingness, you know, as you're basically melted down, do try to find it in your heart to forgive me. So this Nimrod guy, man, he really is like the ultimate in passive aggressive, you know, acting all benevolent when he's doing these evil kind of things. And Cyobel, she's not left without, you know, any fight. She still is, she can't do much, you know, she's trapped physically, but she still espouses, you know, rebellion the best way she can. She's like, you think you're threatening me and that's going to make me tell you what I want to tell you? No, like, I'm not afraid to die for what I believe in. And Omega's like, well, that's good to hear. But dying for a cause, that seems to have been a fatal flaw for your people, for mutants, you know, all along. And they say, unfortunately, while this is a kind of death, it's not one that you can escape from. And they put her in the chamber. And then on the next page, we're told about the kennel, which is the Sentinel mutant breeding camps. So that's where Cyobel came from. The kennel was built to be the pinnacle of the man-machine's breeding program to produce hounds like Cyobel. Hounds are bred and they're supposed to hunt other mutants. They're designed to present as a subspecies with dehumanizing affections. So basically these are meant to generate fear and sympathy in their targets. So they appear to be vulnerable, I guess you would say. And that's how they infiltrate, right? Like they use their abilities, their mutant abilities that are supposed to be able to detect other mutants. And they try to infiltrate by looking vulnerable. So the other mutants feel bad for them. They bring them back. And then, you know, they blow the whistle and then here comes the man-machine supremacy and they're all captured. And that's basically what the hounds are supposed to do. However, the ones in this particular kennel, the Salsin kennel, like where Cyobel came from, those designs were abandoned after only a couple generations because they were too broken. They were too dependent. They weren't effective hunters of other mutants. But there were modified versions of those hounds, like the final ones that were created with the unreadable black brains. So that's what we see when we look at Cyobel. You know, she, like I said, she had that clear plate on her head and you could see her black brain. And those were, even though they were still created and designed with those same sort of characteristics, these ones were then conditioned for insurgency and duplicity. So they were trained to be spies and to double cross, basically. And while only a few of those were successfully deployed and proved to be lethally affected, the majority of them, because again, they're trained and conditioned for insurgency, to be a spy and to be duplicitous, to, you know, to betray, they defected. And they said, well, I've got much more in common with these mutants that I'm supposed to betray. So instead of betraying these mutants, I'm going to betray the man machine supremacy that bred me and trained me. And then they became some of the mutants' most effective warriors. The Sal Sen kennel was destroyed 10 years ago, along with all the biological and research material. So that kennel didn't really work out too well for the man-machine supremacy, and Hickman gives us a great explanation for why. So I do kind of like that. Seems like the man-machine supremacy got a little too clever for their own good here, and got betrayed by a lot of those black brain hounds that they created. So next we see No Place the Hub on the next page, and this is basically the kind of the area you walk through when you walk through a gate to get from wherever the gate was planted, the Black Seed of Krakoa, to Krakoa itself. And we see Rasputin and Cardinal there. So we do know that Rasputin was able to escape, and Cardinal's apologizing. And she's like, yeah, he rather saying, I wish I was made some other way, but I'm not capable of violence. I'd trade places with her if I could. And Rasputin's like, well, you know what? She was gone by the time I was done fighting what was left of that human contingent. And you did nothing. You watched. So right now, I would take your trade, priest. Yeah, she'd happily trade Cardinal for Cyobel at this point. Because again, she's a black brain that's changed sides. And we were just told how they're one of the most effective weapons against the man-machine supremacy. So they do make it back. Cardinal Rasputin make it back to Krakoa. And a voice off panel says, we saw that there were only two of you in transit. What happened? You know, four of them went. And now we finally learn the name of the mutant that died, because Rasputin says Percival's dead. Cyobel probably is too. And then on the next page, we see it's actually Logan that was talking, Wolverine. He says, well, that's too bad. They were both good soldiers. But the question is, did they die for nothing, or was it worth it? Next to Wolverine is Magneto, who now, instead of, you know, first he was red and purple. Recently, we've seen him in the all white. Now he's all green. So I'm not sure what that's about. There's, I don't know, some swamp thing looking guy with a big beard. Groot, maybe? Some sort of Groot monster? I don't know. And then in the background, somebody else who I won't even venture a guess. It looks familiar in a way, but I'm just not sure. But in response to the question by Logan, was it worth it? Cardinal says, yeah, we've got it. And Wolverine says, all right, then follow me. The old man's waiting. Who the old man is, what they actually were able to secure that was worth them losing two of their fellow mutants, we don't know. Because on the next page, again, it's a dialogue page. It's a text page, which I felt like there was a lot more in this issue than there was in House of X number one, which sort of makes sense. House of X number one is set in present time, and the context is a lot easier to grasp, even though it's all new ideas. Whereas this one's in the future, and, you know, clearly we're like, what the hell's going on? So in this one, we're told about the surviving mutants, total mutant population under the man-machine supremacy. So once the war is going, we're told that the current estimated number of surviving mutants is believed to be less than 10,000. Vast majority of them are transplants or refugees who are no longer living on Earth or even in their native solar system. There are two main colonies of refugees that exist in Shi'ar space. The first colony is called Benevolence. It's a converted transit station located on the fringe of Shi'ar space, and it's long served as a buffer between that empire and the wild space spawning grounds of the Brood, who are an ancient enemy of the Shi'ar, who the X-Men have fought various times, very insect-like and just sort of in hive mind, sort of like aliens. The current number of mutants living on Benevolence is just under 8,000. The second mutant colony is located on the Shi'ar throne world of Chandalar. There's about 2,000 mutants who live there by agreement with treaty with the Empire. They're warrior stock for the Imperial Guard, and there are currently 6 mutants who serve as super guardians, and 57 are of sub-guardian classification. And we're told in a little separate box here that it's long been rumored in Imperial circles that the Empress Zandra has had ambitions to annex the solar system that contains Earth. And the reason she has these mutant guardsmen in her Imperial Guard is because when she goes to conquer Earth, the Earthlings will be less likely to fight back when they see sort of familiar faces, as it were. So inside the mutant community, it's hoped that should this come to pass, the surviving mutants could serve as seed stock to repopulate Earth with mutants. As far as the soul mutants that we're told about on the next page, all the living mutants in the soul system, so the solar system that houses Earth, are currently citizens of Asteroid K. After the recent deaths of the X-Hound Silo Bell and the ghost Percival, the current population of Asteroid K is 8. So apparently, especially based on the graphic we have here, because we've got 3 graphics that show the 3 different colonies, as it were. Benevolence, located Shi'ar space, population 7,942. Chandalar, location Shi'ar homeworld, population 1,829. Then Asteroid K, location solar system, population 8. The symbol for Asteroid K is like a rock with a tree growing out of it. So I'm assuming that Krakoa is actually located on Asteroid K. So when you talk about only having 8 people left, well, we just saw 6 of them, right? We saw Wolverine, we saw Magneto, we saw Cardinal, we saw Rasputin, we saw the tree looking guy, and we saw that blue guy with the flaming sort of head. So there's only 2 other ones. And apparently there was 10 if you counted Silo Bell and Percival, but they just died. So now we're down to 8. So what the heck are they doing there? And why is there only 8 of them left? I guess that remains to be seen. When we turn the page, now we jump again even farther. Now we're X-cubed, the X-Men, year 1000. And it says we are losing them. And we're at the archive of Nimrod the Greater. So before, when we were at X-squared, year 100, we were at that tower, that man-machine supremacy monolith for Nimrod the Lesser. Now we're at the archive of Nimrod the Greater, the mutant library, and we actually see Silo Bell here. And apparently she didn't dissolve completely because she's still floating in that tank, clearly dead. But why is she there? What did they find? You know, we don't know. But what we are told by a voice off panel is it says, we are losing them and there's nothing I can do to prevent it. And we see that blue skinned character that we saw on the first page again. She's saying there's too much machinery floating inside there and there's not enough soul to save, let alone copy. And there's a little sort of flying thing that reminded a piece of machinery, kind of reminded me of Skeets from Booster Gold DC. And this flying machine says, the blame is not yours, librarian. It's mine. I simply wasn't built to maintain integrity for a millennium. So, you know, 1,000 years. And the librarian says, it's no one's fault, Nimrod. So apparently this is Nimrod in the year, you know, 1000 or what have you. 1,000 more years in the future. He's not even humanoid anymore, but just this flying looking piece of tech. And she tells Nimrod, yeah, you did exactly what you were made to do. You created a consciousness of all mutantdom, a living database of Homo Superior in order to provide a tactical advantage in a war. So based on that, I guess Nimrod kept capturing mutants and throwing them in that solution like he did Silo Bell, and just, you know, taking whatever it was he needed to take from them to turn them into data. And then with that artificial intelligence that he mentioned was a part of him, created a database of Homo Superior, so they could use that knowledge to then win the war. And the librarian goes on to say, who could have known how pointless and useless that war would be? Who at the time could have seen the surprising end of the human machine mutant war? And Nimrod says, Homo sapiens, so good to be done with all that. So humans no longer exist, I guess. But it is interesting, I guess, you know, with the perspective of 1,000 years, you can say, yeah, the pointless war. And yeah, it was humans, machines, and mutants fighting. So it kind of sounds like, well, they wiped out the machines, wiped out the humans, and they turn around and wiped out the man machine supremacy wiped out the mutants, and then the machines turn around and wiped out the humans. I don't know. The librarian doesn't look humanoid, but blue, but their head cranial area is much larger than a human. But Nimrod saying, yeah, glad to be done with humans. A librarian says, but are we done with them? Can we ever really be done with the past? After all, that's what a legacy is, right? And it's why we keep dinosaur bones around. And as they're saying this, she's walked out and she's looking down at a city, and there's some kind of dome there. And it kind of looks like a dome you would see over a part of Krakoa. Because as we zoom in on it, we see trees, we see birds, and the librarian saying, yeah, it's a reminder of what the world used to be like and what we overcame. And it's important to keep a record of the mistakes that we made in the past, and even preserve a remnant, something to point at, and hope to God we you know, never have dominion again. And as we zoom in, it's like, yeah, we see birds, we see trees, we see at least a simulation of sunlight, and we even see what looks to be humans there, some sort of an Adam and Eve kind of thing. So what are they breeding humans in captivity there? Is it a zoo? Did they just keep it as a reminder? They have plans. Again, like, who knows? Come to the last page here, and it's the quote from Rasputin that he said earlier, or that she said earlier, rather, to Cardinal, saying, you've forgotten that machines have no soul and that humans lost theirs a long time ago. And we're shown the reading order, and that's it for the issue. So, yeah, it's a lot to unpack, and I know I went through it kind of quickly, but I think I explained it pretty well. Anything you think I missed, John Paul?
Well, for me, I make connections because I've read past this, and so I'm holding my tongue because I, you know, to spoil what comes next. So,
gotcha.
I'm just holding the opinions.
Yeah, fair enough. And again, this is. It's really advanced stuff when you start talking about what Hickman has done and how he's built out everything. And, you know, we mentioned it several times, how there's so much here in these text pages, and don't really see how it works any other way. But what I kind of have a hard time with is, because this is so different and it is so new, like, is it necessary? And again,
what part?
Well, could he have done this at a later time? Would it have made more sense to do it at a later time? I guess at this point, I just don't see the significance of talking about anything that's 100 years in the future, or certainly 1,000 years in the future. Like, how much is that going to play into, you know, year one, basically, or year zero, or whatever it is that he calls it, that meeting that we saw of Xavier and Moira. So I just wonder about that. And I mean, usually if you're an X-Men fan and you want to read an X-Men book, it needs to have some X-Men in it. And other than Logan showing up kind of on the last page, basically, you don't really get much here. I mean, obviously you have Professor X, you know, right at the beginning. And then, yeah, not much of anything else. So, I don't remember at the time hearing anybody say, well, I hated it. I hated Powers of X, number one. I remember a lot of people saying they were really confused by it, and I can see why. So, I mean, yeah, it's an interesting story. It's interesting the way that Hickman built it out, but the argument could be made. This isn't really an X-Men story. This isn't really an X-Men book, at least not in terms of you seeing anything familiar. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
So
I just, you know, I think he's trying to build on new ideas, because a lot of the stuff that was going on had been done before, and it was starting to, for some people, it was starting to get stale.
Yeah, I can see that. And, you know, he does a good job. Like I said, I mean, the concepts themselves, you know, the idea of hounds, and, you know, we've got Nimrod and, you know, Sentinels and that kind of thing, that, and certainly the persecution and hunting mutants and all that, those concepts are all familiar. I guess you could say he's just putting in a new concept.
Well, I wouldn't give away details, but there is an issue. I can't remember if it's, I'm pretty sure his powers are 10, but I don't know what issue. That's like, whew, so far, it really doesn't feel X-Men like at all. And I don't know where that one's going to go, but that one I has the least amount of ties to anything current X-Men, including what's going on right now. But I think that's very much so the end game. We'll talk more about it when we get to it.
Yeah, it's so interesting. The other thing about this is, let's talk about the art for a minute. We did mention the panel with the really
beady eyes,
like the little orphan Annie eyes, I'll call them. He just has these two black circles for eyes. But it almost seems like RB Silva is trying to use a little more of a cartoony style when we're in year zero, because the art gets, I feel like, significantly better. Like the line work and the detail gets significantly better when we jump the 10 years. And then again, when we, it feels even a little more refined when we jump to 100 years. And then 100 years and 1,000 years feels about the same. But I don't know. You think that's purposeful?
Well, I don't know. I liken his style to a little less, more realism and more cartoony. And also, what was I trying to say? I don't know. I think he uses like the anime expressions a lot more, you know?
Yeah.
I see the anime inspiration.
Yeah, I guess that could be true. And he's even letting the anime influence show up even more in the year zero. Cause again, it's what we get the least amount of. And it's basically some human moments between Moira and Professor X, as opposed to the rest of it is, well, the year 10 stuff isn't necessarily action, but the year 100 stuff is all action. Whereas the year 10 stuff's more politic. And I guess the year 1000 is too esoteric to say what it is. We don't have enough context, but
still though.
Yeah. Yeah. I
wouldn't. There are some clarifications though, later on though, when you put it all together, it definitely becomes clear, the whole ascension concept.
Gotcha. Yep. Well, it seems to me that the most important part of this book and what he spends the majority of his time fleshing out is that year 100. I mean, that's when we talk about all those text pages, they all have to do with, you know, that era of the man-machine supremacy and the human-mutant machine war. You know, we're told about the chimeras, we're told about the hounds, we're told about the betrayal. So it does seem to be a pretty important part. I wonder if, you just wonder, like, does Hickman have some sort of 10-year plan? Like, are we going to get at some point the beginnings of the man-machine supremacy? Or are we going to get a book that is set in this year 100 with, you know, Rasputins and Cardinals and what have you?
I'd be sincerely disappointed if we didn't at least get like a few one shots with that, you know, because if not, what was this for? You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. And yeah, it's interesting enough to me that I'm like, okay, well, it's the majority of this issue. And, right. You know, at some point, are we not going to, you know, to flesh it out? So I don't know. I'm really curious. Well, I guess that's it for me. I don't really have, you know, much else to say because I have, again, more questions than answers. Is it an entertaining book? Yeah. Is it filled with cool and interesting ideas? Yeah. Does it raise more questions than it answers? 100% it does. but I'm not as far along as you, but it sounds like you still have a lot of questions as well. But anything else that you want to add about this Powers of 10 number one?
Let's see, without spoiling it. The first thing I the Nimrod and how he his personality in this, mm-hmm. like, kind of threw me for at first because, you know, I think of Nimrod as an unfeeling machine with yeah. like no sense of humor,
right?
And him kind of throwing out these patronizing comments it was funny, and I was like, is this the Nimrod that I know? But I liked it.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it shows just an advancement because I kind of thought the same thing. I'm like, wait, this is supposed to be Nimrod. He doesn't, because to me, Nimrod's a little bit of a mustache twirling villain, you know?
Right.
He's kind of what's the word I'm looking for? Like unapologetically just evil and just right. follows his programming. But then I took that as, okay, well, so this version of Nimrod, his artificial intelligence has advanced enough that he kind of understands more nuance, you know, where he's trying to, you know, seem like he's a good guy. Oh, I'm sorry. And, you know, this and that, but he's not as advanced enough to really know that it comes across as being insincere was the kind of the way that I took it, you know, because Silo Bell certainly doesn't fall for any of his garbage, you know?
Right.
Like, no, this is not, because he doesn't understand that, because he doesn't actually have the emotions. He's just, you know, it's still all just programming. And so he's saying it, but he's not really feeling it. So that's why it comes across as sort of, you know, insincere. So yeah, it was interesting. And it's interesting writing. I think this book more than House of X number one feels like a Hickman book. Like this real, not that House of X one didn't feel like a Hickman book, but this is like, it's Hickman all the way. It reminds me a lot of his East of West series where, you know, you're getting these really esoteric ideas and, you know, we're jumping way far in the future and you're getting these text pages with these info dumps. And yeah, I mean, I think it's good. It's interesting. I did read it twice. And I think I got more out of it the second time. And then even as I was going through and describing the action, I caught a couple things that I didn't. So it's one of those books that if you haven't read it at all, I think it takes multiple reads to pull everything out of it. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I agree. I agree with that. Yeah. And then I think it's even more important to go back to it now that I have gone back to it and reread mm-hmm. it after you've gone through the Dawn of X and into the Reign of X. You're more informed and it's like, oh, okay, I get it. You know,
with that.
I mean, you don't get everything, but you do you get more. Like, I have some theories about this Groot looking character and who that would be, but I'll save that for later.
Okay. Well, I think that's going to do it for this episode, everybody. Again, we want to thank everybody for listening. Be sure you're following us on social media and all of all that stuff. We'll be continuing with our look, and the House of X number two is on our slate for next Tuesday, unless I can get to it and release it, give you guys two episodes this week. So we'll see if we can make that happen. But anyway, thanks for listening as always, and we'll talk to you next time.
You can find the Comic Source Podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, or whichever podcasting app you prefer. Please tell all your friends about us, subscribe, and rate us. The ratings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on Apple. Also, be sure to visit us at lrmonline.com to join the conversation, access the show notes, and discover all our other great pop culture content. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. So once again, we want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.